From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noah.
They call me Ben. You, of course, are you, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Today, we're delving into a conspiracy, not a conspiracy theory, more than 100 years old, and it's one that still affects the world today.
Something that sounds like a story just ripped straight from some kind of Tom Clancy political thriller, but it actually happened.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's really about this bigger idea that a single person can, for better or worse, actually change the world.
It's like what your mom told you, only true.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So travel back with us, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the early 20th century. There are all sorts of dramatic breakthroughs in technology. There are all sorts of fundamentally historic human moments. But unbeknownst to most, the world was inching closer and closer to a deadly global conflict. And it's what we today refer to as World War I.
What was World War I, you ask? Well, we shall tell you, starting with the fact that World War I began in July of 1914 and lasted until November of 1918. And during that time, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire, also known as the Central Powers, fought against Great Britain, France, Russia, Italy, Romania, Japan, and the United States, a.k.a. the Allied Powers.
And thanks to a lot of this new technology that Ben alluded to earlier, we're talking about trench warfare, mustard gas, all kinds of the types of tank that you could build at that time. It saw unprecedented levels, World War I did, of carnage and just human destruction.
Just utter, utter inhumane brutality.
Yeah, atrocities. Mm-hmm. And by the time this conflict was over, the Allied powers claimed victory, but it's at best a Pyrrhic victory because we're talking about a death toll of more than 16 million people, civilians and soldiers alike.
I mean, with the technology that we have now and the way we can target airstrikes, our casualty rates just pale in comparison to what we're talking about here. I mean, this was just astronomical numbers.
And, oh, buddy, if you think that European political relations are complicated and screwy now, are you in for a wild ride? In the early 20th century, Europe was very much a continent in transition with a quagmire of ever-shifting alliances, rival powers, and often contradictory aims. And when we say, like, a continent in transition, there were powerhouse economies like Austria-Hungary and Germany. And then there were places like Poland, and this is a war where occasionally there would be a group of people with tanks and a group of people on horses.
Yeah.
Which is very strange. Sounds like time travel gone wrong. Even now, 100 years later, a century more later, scholars and historians continue to debate the causes of this war. We have a little overview for you of some of the most often cited contributing factors.
One of the biggest ones is this concept of mutual defense agreements. So countries that have signed contracts, treaties between them, where if one nation gets attacked, the other one will step in to defend it. Mm-hmm. So you've got all these allied countries that were required through these contractual agreements to defend other countries. There were all kinds of alliances. Russia and Serbia.
Okay.
Germany and Austria-Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
France and Russia. Britain and France and Belgium, and Japan and Britain. And you can already see, or you can imagine, with all of these different groups, if a single one of these gets attacked, it's going to create this lethal domino effect.
Yeah, and several are on multiple lists, right? Like Russia is on two lists. They have an agreement with Serbia and France.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't talk about too much of my past, but as you guys know, I was at a time very close to joining the State Department before what I would call irreconcilable creative differences led us apart. And one of the things that always got me is, although international relations are very, very complicated, there is one or two, there are a couple of great analogies. And one is, although it can be daunting to hear all these names thrown around, don't picture these countries as nations. Picture the world as a house party.
Yeah.
And every nation is a person at this house party. And there's a limited amount of beer or chips. And everybody's making deals with each other to say how they're going to divide the stuff up, right?
Yeah.
And inevitably...
Are there ruffles?
Something goes wrong. Well, of course there are ruffles, man. This is big time.
Is there onion dip?
You know, that's a good question.
Is it homemade?
You got to be careful with onion dip. You know, it's not, they're not all onion dips are created equal. And if you have a good recipe for one, do send it to us.
Now, surely you can probably onion dip into this description here.
Sure. Yeah. Onion dip would be another resource. Let's say onion dip was, onion dip would be like oil in that case, right?
No, beer is oil, dude.
Beer is oil?
Yeah. Because there's so much beer at this house party.
Okay. All right.
And they're running out.
And they're running out. And you can already see, as Matt said, this lethal domino effect. So what happened in World War One is, it's going to sound a little bit complicated, and we do want to make sure everybody knows, when we say Austria-Hungary, it's with a hyphen because that was one country.
Yes.
All right. So Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. Russia got involved because they're tight with Serbia. Germany saw Russia mobilizing, and they declared war on Russia. And then France had to hang out because they have an agreement with Russia. And so they were going against Germany and Austria-Hungary. Germany attacked France through Belgium, and when Belgium got pulled in, that meant that Britain had to go in. And then Japan was like, also me. And then later, Italy and the U.S. would enter, but not at the beginning. That's just one illustration. That's just one contributing factor, and there are other ones too.
I think the U.S. also kind of has always, even like in World War II, had this sense that, oh, this isn't for us. This is, we're not, this is the, everybody else's problem.
Yeah.
We're kind of listening to it on the radio and hanging back, but then there's this sense that, oh, crap, maybe we are going to get pulled into this mess. And then, of course, inevitably, that's what happens.
Yeah, we're very much an isolationist country for a long time.
I'm totally just imagining the house party
in
the U.S. just being like, bro, what are you doing, bro? And then going in. They have to get involved.
Well, the U.S. is also...
Get your hands off my Yeti, bro!
The U.S. is also separated by two oceans and resource-rich. So at this party, they're like in somebody else's room, eating their own food, rubbing their own Yeti.
Mm.
They're like, wow, it sounds rough out there. Yeah, rubbing your Yeti is not a euphemism.
Yeah, what is a Yeti?
It's a fancy cooler.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But now that phrase, rubbing their own Yeti, is going to stick with people.
Yep.
Hey, what's imperialism?
Good question, Ben. I'm glad you asked. As it turns out, imperialism is a whole lot like a Yeti cooler. Not at all, though. Before World War One, you see, Africa and parts of Asia were points of contention in, among, rather, the European countries. So many European countries, they sought to expand their spheres of influence by building empires. So with the U.S. functioning as an independent entity all on its own in that isolationist way we just described, Europeans were forced to make trade deals with us, the U.S., which at the time, and you know, continues to be quite resource rich. This was an important source of natural resources for some of these other countries. So rather than enjoying the advantages of mercantilism, they had to deal.
But like with peers.
Right.
So,
right.
In African and Asian societies, however, this meant that they would continue to bear the brunt of brutal colonial actions, resource extraction. Why pay for a mine or give people a living wage when you can go in and plunder and murder them?
You know, I used to be in a hardcore band called Brutal Colonial Action.
Oh, yeah?
Totally.
What instrument did you play?
The musket.
You played the musket?
Whoa,
oh, yeah, I'm familiar with your work, man.
Takes a long time to play a note.
And it really does.
Yeah, it's like you're the guy with the cymbals who's all in every large orchestra who's just waiting for that shot.
They weren't using muskets in World War One.
Yeah, you
I'm
know.
I
we're just time traveling, man. It's cool.
Right
stuff on. Gets, you know, stuff gets like woven in.
I guarantee you someone had a musket. I guarantee you. You're not going to throw away a perfectly good musket.
So true.
So the raw materials and the resources these places could provide were seen as crucial to many European nations, not just for expansion, but for maintenance and functioning, right? And this increasing competition, this desire for larger and larger empires led to an increase in military confrontations and skirmishes, which leads us to another cause, militarism. An arms race began at the dawn of the 20th century. By 1914, Germany had the largest buildup. Great Britain and Germany really significantly increased their naval forces. And this is very important, in Germany and Russia especially, the military became an increasingly dominant force in politics and public policy, exerting massive influence. And remember, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, and then comes in this wonderful thing called nationalism that is a double-edged sword, but it can do great things as well. So each of these separate nations mm-hmm. wants to be the big potato. That's not a thing, but
the big potato,
the biggest
I like
potato
it.
Of the bunch.
Yeah.
You know, they want to have the largest amount of influence, mm-hmm. Resource control, mm-hmm. economic wealth within their country and all kinds of trade with other countries.
Yeah. Make the most delicious wedges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
they have like the sour cream and the chives.
Yes. They want to be the big cheese potato. So past wars and all these battles that have mm-hmm. occurred throughout history up until this time had drawn all these national borders, but in various countries, there are ethnic minorities that consider themselves unfairly lumped into one of these nations, like under control of perhaps laws that they don't agree with because that line got drawn.
Would that be similar to like the Israeli-Palestinian issue?
It would be. It would be similar because there would be people who in the United Nations, maybe another example would be like the Balkans, but in the mm-hmm. United Nations, viewing of a country, it just goes by what everybody else agreed forms the borders of that country. And for instance, in parts of the African continent, the borders were specifically and purposely drawn to separate concentrations of communities or tribes, right?
Yeah.
And that's where you go. That's where you arrive at things like the war in Rwanda.
Yep.
Where the Hutu and the Tutsi had a brutal war.
I get that, Ben. That's a great example.
It's also kind of like in India, the border regions of India and Pakistan. There's all kinds of conflicts that occur there because of some of these differences.
I'll tell you what, though, that ceremony where they close and open the gate is amazing.
One of my favorite YouTube things mm-hmm. to do.
It's 15 minutes long and it's worth every second. So specifically, much of the origin of World War I was based on the desire of Slavic people in Bosnia and Herzegovina to break off from the country of Austria-Hungary and become part of a greater mm-hmm. United Serbia. Because they're like, why are you in control? We're Serbian.
Yep.
We're not Austrian, you know. But there was one more thing, a match to the powder keg. With all these burgeoning tensions, rivalries, and races for riches, it seemed Europe was teetering on the brink of calamity. And all it would take is one more push.
Boop. That was the push.
Yeah.
Actually, it was more like...
That push, exactly, was the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand on the 28th of June in 1914.
Can we just take this opportunity real quick to say that Franz Ferdinand was a pretty underrated band? Whatever happened to those guys? Are they still around?
I wonder if they listen to the show.
They've got
to
be around.
You think so?
Yeah. Sure.
They probably still are in contact with each other.
What about the Arctic Monkeys?
Oh, they're definitely together. They had a huge album just a year or two, a couple years ago.
Yeah. And I think that one guy might go solo. The lead...
The main monkey?
Yep.
Well, anyway, this band that we're talking about took their name from Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was assassinated on the 28th of June in 1914. Mm-hmm. And while many of the circumstances leading to the war were totally in place at this point, and the war may have, at this point, ultimately been considered to be inevitable, the death of this single elite mm-hmm. aristocrat mm-hmm. was the match that lit the fuse of aforementioned powder keg.
Yes, the feather that broke the camel's back, the penny that shattered the train station.
The badger that broke out of the bag and mm-hmm. massacred mm-hmm. everyone.
Yeah.
Yep, the final potato that got microwaved a little too long. Nope, not that one.
No, keep it. The dog who kept barking at the Son of Sam.
All right, so this death was the result of one of the Western world's most significant conspiracies.
Have you heard of the Black Hand?
Well, you will hear about it right after a word from our sponsor.
Here's where it gets crazy.
The Black Hand, also known as Unification or Death, was a secret military society formed in May of 1911 by officers in the Army of the Kingdom of Serbia. They were hellbent for leather on uniting all of the territories with a South Slavic majority not ruled by either Serbia or Montenegro.
The precursor of this secret group had already assassinated the Serbian royal couple in 1903. Both the Black Hand and its precursor were led by a fellow named Captain Dragutin Dimitrijevic, often called by the codename Apis, which is a god from Egyptian mythology. And I do want to say that none of us are Serbian, so we are not going to pronounce these names as native speakers.
Yes. Thank you, Ben. You're correct.
So what is this Black Hand conspiracy, although other than sounding like an amazing band name?
Well, okay, so then you have to go back to 1911, and that's when this group tried to assassinate Franz Joseph. He was the current, at that time, ruler of Austria-Hungary. This dude, he's an old gentleman, he's in his 80s, and for a couple of reasons, they failed. And then they turned their attention to this dude's heir, who was Franz Ferdinand.
Yes. This is a tricky part of history. So Apis, the captain, the leader of the Black Hand, wanted Franz Ferdinand dead not because he was oppressing the Slavic minority living in his kingdom under his rule, but because he was planning to make important concessions to the South Slavs that he controlled. This would make the Black Hand's dream of a unified Serbia much, much more difficult. Why would you throw a revolution if your home country is making improvements on its own?
Yeah, they're just seeing, or they're imagining there are going to be these small incremental moves, right, that it's going to take, I don't know, decades, maybe centuries to get what they want. Let's do it quickly. Pull that Band-Aid off.
And the Black Hand was not acting alone. They worked in concert with another group named Narodna Odbrana, and its satellite organizations, particularly a group named Young Bosnia. Narodna Odbrana was older and more established, so this gave the Black Hand massive street cred.
So by 1914, the conspiracy had enlarged to a membership, including hundreds of individuals, many of whom were officers in the Serbian army. They trained guerrilla fighters and taught saboteurs similar in many ways to the way current intelligence agencies train revolutionaries in other countries. And it's not easy to keep an international revolutionary terrorist freedom fighter organization ring a secret. It's hard. Takes the work of many. So members had very little knowledge of the overall organization. It was on a need-to-know basis. They would know only the member of their cell and one superior who gave them orders.
Yeah, it feels a lot like secret societies that we looked into in the past.
Or possibly the way modern-day terrorist cells are operated.
Even the government, the military, like, you may not know who's functioning.
They're called cells because they're self-contained. And they don't have a line to others. They cannot give information that would lead to the capture of anyone outside of their little unit.
And they can function independently. So this, you know, this is a very successful strategy. There's a reason people stick with it. The Serbian government, it seems, was aware of this force, aware of the Black Hand and at least some of its activities, though they may not have known exactly how many people who were supposed to be working for the government were working for the Black Hand. This became a nightmarish time to be a member of the official government because once upon a time, it was politically dangerous to disagree with the Black Hand, like disagreeing with a powerful lobbying group and still wanting to be in politics here. But by 1914, it was physically dangerous because this group saw politically motivated murders as just another tool, like out there with, you know, pamphlets. Say, oh, and distributed some pamphlets, and we had to shoot this one guy. Don't worry, we made sure everybody knew it was us.
You ever handled a pamphlet, man? Those edges will nick you. They are dangerous.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's a statistic about how many people are grievously injured by pamphlets. If not, then just us putting out into the ether will mean that it is now created.
Uh-oh.
Someone's going to write back to us with information about pamphlets. Oh, my gosh, send us a pamphlet about pamphlets.
Any pamphlets will do. Send them our way. So it's commonly believed
that you better use legitimate postage.
Oh, yeah, which we'll get to later in this episode.
Yes, we will.
So now it is believed that Apis recruited six Bosnian Serbs for this assassination attempt, and he was really hoping to exterminate Franz Ferdinand before he improved, like we said, the life of the Serbs in Austria-Hungary. And these six men were smuggled across the border in an arrangement similar to that of the famous Underground Railroad, and they were trained in bomb-making, deployment, and marksmanship. And now, although the prime minister attempted to stop these guys from leaving the country, the official government was largely helpless when attempting to oppose these guys, the Black Hand in general. And it had eaten all of the power structure that existed in the country from within. The Black Hand was like this rot that was occurring.
It was a deep state.
Yeah.
Is the term we would use today, right?
Mm-hmm.
To this day, scholars don't agree on how sincere the prime minister's efforts were. Was he... really, was it really a matter of him having his hands tied, or was he more like Gene Wilder and Willy Wonka going, oh no, stop, help, please,
you know? Don't fall in the chocolate.
Well, one thing's for sure, the men, the six terrorists, arrived in Sarajevo and kicked it for a month, waiting for the time to strike, and absolutely nothing was done to stop them.
You gotta remember, it's a little harder to track human beings at this time, right? Mm-hmm. Just to give a little bit of that, like,
no,
hey,
GPS?
Yeah.
Let's look at the day of. So a month passes. One of the terrorists, a fellow named Nedeljko, was the first to act. He threw a bomb at the Archduke's car. There was a guy who was supposed to throw a bomb earlier, but for some reason he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So he threw the bomb. The Archduke, who was with his pregnant wife at the time, tried to cover her. The driver said some version of like hot pennies. I don't know. I don't want to curse on the show. And so he slammed on the gas and the bomb, the guy who threw it forgot that the bomb had a 10-second delay. So it fell off the bumper and hit a car of completely innocent people who happened to be behind the Archduke.
Mm.
Jeez.
And this guy, Nedeljko, had tuberculosis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And had already kind of decided this was going to be his last hurrah, a total suicide mission. So after throwing the bomb, he swallowed a cyanide pill. And to make certain that he died, he also, this isn't funny, but it's a little
really,
intense.
It's rough.
It's intense. Yeah. He also jumped into a nearby river.
Unfortunately, the pill did not work. It only made him sick. And the river he jumped into, because it was a dry season, was only a few centimeters deep.
Now that is funny.
And God. So he got dragged out of the river and arrested. Talk about a bad, bad day.
Would it have been a better day if he had died? I don't know. We're splitting hairs here.
Bad day for him.
Yeah, fair enough.
Now imagine you're one of the other conspirators who are trying to take this out. And
you're just like, fuck.
Well, you just watch all of this go down. You watch the bomb bounce, hit another car.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Other dude grabs a cyanide and then jumps off and then splats into the shallow river.
And people pull him out while he's throwing up.
And you're just going,
And the crowd beat the living tar out of this man before the police got to him. So, yeah, you're watching this. These other assassins are watching. They're depressed. They're upset. They wonder what they should do now. And I'm telling you guys, the God's honest truth, one of the terrorists, a 19-year-old named Gavrilo Princip, was like, forget this. I'm going to go get a sandwich.
Yep.
I don't care what you guys do. I'm going to get a sandwich. He walked to the local deli. To be fair, a lot of historians nowadays say that he knew the route the car would take and purposely went there to wait. But I like imagining somebody getting frustrated and going to get a sandwich.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, the Archduke, who is understandably PO'd, insists on continuing his journey, going to the hospital. They want to change the route for safety purposes, but nobody told the driver.
Whoa.
And to give a shout out to a fellow podcast, when we went to the NYC Podfest, we saw Aaron from Lore do a live reading of an unpublished, he hasn't done this as an episode story, involving this entire fiasco and a haunted car. Man, I hope he releases that because that was the coolest story he told that night.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, so on to further debacle. So no one told the driver about the change in the plan. The bodyguard noticed, told the driver, and the driver decided to turn around. The street where they turned the car happened to have a deli. Oh, my goodness.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
What a coinkydink. And so it just so happened that as a particularly depressed assassin, a failed assassin, a would-be assassin, walked out of the deli with his delicious confection. I wish history
knew what kind of sandwich it was.
I feel like sandwich history is sort of a lost... I feel like we can learn a lot from the sandwiches of history.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Absolutely.
We could have known what was going on in this man's mind.
Yeah, even the story of condiments is amazing.
Totally. So he walks out of the deli with his mystery sandwich, and what should he see but the Archduke's very car, not 10 feet away from his delectable deli treat.
His shame sandwich.
Yes. The car was, at this point, stopping and attempting to reverse directly in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened next, Matt?
Yeah, that's when he pulled out his gun and he fired two times. One, the first shot hit Archduke and hit him in his neck.
Mm-hmm, in his jugular.
Yep, so he was going to be done. And the second one hit the Archduke's pregnant wife in her stomach.
And just to go back to the lore thing, and a big part of this guy's story is the unreliable narrator. So part of the point of the story as he told it wasn't clear if everything was true. But I like this detail, the idea that this kid basically blind fired into a crowd and like managed to like pop off these two deadly shots.
And he attempted to swallow a cyanide pill as well. This one also did not work.
Are they getting these cyanide pills?
From a person who's really bad at making cyanide pills.
Yeah, seriously.
Discount cyanide store.
So as he raised his gun to his temple, the deed was done. Sic Semper Tyrannis and all that. So he's ready to take his own life. But authorities intervened, arrested him before he could shoot himself. Imagine a hand grabbing the wrist and now it just fires into the air. And they, of course, beat the ever-loving Christ out of the guy. But they kept him alive and they kept him in jail. And that's when we saw the immediate aftermath. Things escalated.
This is when you start to see the conspiracy begin to be exposed to the authorities, or at least officially, and the right people are starting to see it. The inevitable events were all set in motion. So Germany and Austria-Hungary demanded a massive investigation into what exactly happened, how did this happen, and who was involved.
And the Serbian prime minister gave zero, since we're a family show, I'll say franks.
Yep, zero francs.
He gave zero francs about it. He literally told them that not only did he not know anything about this plot, but that, quote, nothing had been done so far, and the matter did not concern the Serbian government.
Ooh.
Germany asked Russia to intercede. Russia was like, eh.
Nah.
Yeah.
So then, on 23rd of July, Austria-Hungary issued a letter with 10 demands to ensure the destruction of the anti-Austrian network in Serbia. And this document became known as the July Ultimatum, and here are a few choice excerpts. So they cited earlier international agreements respecting sovereignty and peaceful relations. Mm-hmm. They also gave Serbia 48 hours to respond, so they put a clock on that biz. And then Serbia accepted all but one demand, which was to allow Austrian military investigators into Serbian territories.
But it turns out there was another conspiracy at play here. Austria, you see, Austria-Hungary, had absolutely no intention of accepting anything. They were set to reject whatever response Serbia gave, and they were doing this because Germany wanted a full-scale war, and this was the perfect opportunity. On July 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war.
Hold on, you're saying Germany wanted to start a world war?
History's long.
It is indeed. Why don't we hear a quick word from our sponsor?
And we're back. Now, multiple shows have examined World War I in various facets. There have been many wonderful books written about it. When I say wonderful, I don't mean they're a joy to read. I mean they're very well written.
Yeah, they're full of information.
So we're looking at just this small conspiracy, this powder keg, right? And rather than the war entire. So our big question is, what became of the Black Hand?
So there were multiple conspirators involved in this fiasco, and they were exposed. So they were caught, and they served prison time or were executed. So then towards the end of 1916, the Prime Minister of Serbia decided the Hand had outlived its usefulness and resolved to destroy the organization.
Yeah, but it seems like such a difficult thing to do once all of those tendrils have been released and the cells exist separately, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, you can cut off the head, you know, you can cut off one head of a multi-headed monster and, you know.
Send a message at
Hail
least.
Hail Hydra.
Ooh. So by 1917, this prime minister had arrested a lot of the leaders. Like you said, you start taking out the people who are making decisions, including Apis.
The leader of the Black Hand was subjected to a real-life kangaroo court. And a kangaroo court is much less fun than it sounds.
Yep.
Kangaroo court is something where it's a farce rather than a real legal investigation. So despite the fact that he and his other co-conspirators were very obviously not the assassins of this other assassination attempt, he was convicted of it, and he, along with three colleagues, was executed by firing squad on the 26th of June, 1917.
Mm.
And for many, this is a significant ending milestone in the story of the Black Hand. And increasingly, as history continues, you know, this is further and further and further away from us now. If I've done the math right, no one listening to our show was around when this happened. I don't want to pigeonhole anybody. So if you were there firsthand, if you used to hang out at a sandwich shop in Sarajevo, let us know. But right now, I mean, we're joking a little bit, but right now it leads us to the immediate question, which is, why should we still remember this story?
Well, because really this is just one example of how easily this thing that we call civilization, all of the organization, all of the working together and the economies and all of this, how easily it can collapse in on itself with one small little thing because of disagreements between groups of people.
Mm-hmm. And there's a big, big difference today. Our species possesses weapons of war capable of flattening the planet and damn near everything on it. And we're literally, we could be one wrong turn away from that.
Yikes. And you have to imagine this Black Hand that was operating inside this government, right? In all parts of it, or a lot of various different parts, you have to imagine today, if you look at, I'm going to use the United States government and military as an example because that's where we are. But if there are small cells, splinter groups that believe very wholeheartedly a certain way, believe that, just as an example, that the United States should break up again and turn into independent states, right? You have a small group of operatives who exist. And they're in high places, they're in low places, they're strategically placed throughout the government and the military. That is a possibility. That's a hypothetical, complete hypothetical. But that kind of thing could exist anywhere. And when you bring into play, like you said, Ben, our technology to destroy the world, it's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, it's the problem is not that it's possible, it's that it's plausible, you know. And then Noel, I think you raised a great point when you said it's almost certain that there's some version of this somewhere that exists now with access to weapons that people in World War One could not imagine. So if those groups exist, and we're not saying that we have proof that they do, but if they exist, what are they up to? For now, that's the stuff they don't want you to know. And we'd like to know what you think about this. What lessons can we learn from the Black Hand? Do you have you heard any theories in your neck of the global woods about the activities of any similar group? And speaking of hearing from you, that reminds me, it's time for
Shout Out Corners.
Our first shout out comes from Linnell. I hope I'm saying that right, Linnell. If I'm not, I just said it twice incorrectly. Linnell says, Hi, Ben, Matt, and Noel. I've enjoyed your show for some time and finally had an excuse to write in. I am a chemist working for a small chemical company, and for many years, one of my primary jobs was to answer questions from customers. I got a call several years ago from a man with a heavy accent looking for red mercury. I had never heard of this, and the man did not give much of an explanation about what he was looking for. The name didn't make sense to me as a chemist, and the call, it remained a mystery until I listened to your episode. Now I wonder if I had a conversation with a would-be terrorist. Oh, and Linnell says, love the show. Please continue exploring the strange ideas out there. Thank you so much, Linnell.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear from someone with firsthand experience of getting a call for red mercury.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still on the fence about that one, guys. I don't, you know, is it all a Shaggy Dog story? I am still not sure. So thank you so much for writing in, Linnell. And our next letter arrives from Jenna. She says, hi, guys. I love the podcast, but something really bothered me about the last episode's shout out corner. I listen to the podcast because you often examine things from multiple sides. The letter you read about vaping did not do that. It encouraged people to deny that vaping is dangerous. That is a conspiracy, and to not believe their doctors. That is not all the sides. My father and I fought about his smoking my entire life. And a couple of years ago, he was excited to have almost quit entirely due to vaping. Only a few months later, he died, and I was devastated. It was 2 days before Christmas. The cause of death was not being able to fight off pneumonia due to popcorn lung, something that happens when you smoke vapors. I was so happy he had quit, and it killed him. Please, please, please let people know that there are two sides to this issue and vaping can kill you. Could the tobacco industry be trying to shut it down? Of course, I'm sure they are. But the reality is that vaping is just as dangerous as tobacco. I would not want someone else to lose their father because I said nothing. My father and I loved history and conspiracy theories. I'm gutted to have found your podcast after he died. He would have loved it. And I thank you for getting me through really hard times. But please, when it comes to issues like this, present both sides. Thank you, Jenna.
Wow. That's terrible, Jenna. Sorry that happened to your father.
That's a reaction to a letter from a previous episode where someone wrote to us saying that they think vaping is a conspiracy.
Yes. And just to jump in here, I did a little bit of research on this, further research, and it appears that a lot of the issues with vaping arise from certain food additives that are meant for flavoring.
Right.
And it exists usually in fruity flavors,
mm-hmm.
and it's not as common as the deadly chemicals are that exist in cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's still a problem.
And there's no doubt that when the vape phenomenon kind of hit full bore, that there wasn't as much oversight of these various products and additives as the cigarette industry obviously has to deal with. So, you know, there was a lot of early adopters and not a lot of research that was available as to what the actual implications of using this. People just automatically assumed that it's not carcinogenic because it's not, you know, it's not cigarettes. It's not,
you're not burning carbon
monoxide right. in your lungs.
But there's not a 50-year study yet.
Well, yep. And as we see little things trickle out, whether it's this popcorn lung study or whether it's other, you know, side effects of vaping.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time, you know, yep. and the cigarette industry's been around for a long time. So it's the kind of thing where we certainly wouldn't have intentionally said one was better than the other. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, like, kind of rolling the dice with anything you put in your body, right?
And we really appreciated your letter, Jenna, and we wanted to get it out there because so often when something is a newer technology in, like, the public eye,
mm-hmm.
people tend to I don't want to say deify it, but they tend to look at it through rose-tinted glasses.
Yes. Totally. You know? Like, this is the safe alternative to cigarettes.
Because it's fixing a problem, right? A lot of new technologies are meant to make a slight adjustment on a problem that exists.
And then you got marketing that just doubles down on that
Absolutely.
Effect, you know? So, it's definitely a tricky territory, and I'm sure no one intended to come across as promoting
right.
anything like that.
Yeah. And as we always say, listeners, your choices, of course, are your own. It is not within our purview to tell anyone what to do, but we do want to assure people that a lot of advertisements are meant to sell something to you rather than educate you.
Thank you for writing in, Jenna.
And then finally, we have a shout out from Dave. He says, in your episode about red mercury, you guys wondered why bother to make fake stamps.
Yes. Oh, Dave, my hero. Tell me about
this. What is the profit margin in that? Well, aside from use on postage, mass mailing, stamps were once used as a cash substitute. I personally prefer seashells. That's me, Noel Brown, talking, not Dave. Accepted by a lot of mail order concerns for low dollar transactions.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's funny. That makes sense. Yeah. I can see that. And I think I've heard that before. I think I've heard that before. Yeah, totally.
That's cool.
So, then, in a letter to the New York Times on October 10th of 1862, Postmaster James Wakefield stated that Congress had authorized, quote, postal currency to be issued through the Treasury Department, which later evolved into postal money orders. Mm. So at first, postal currency was issued in set dollar amounts, and it was common to use stamps to make up the cents. In addition, the Treasury did not provide the post office with sufficient notes for the need, although the postmaster noted that postage stamps are made available for the prepayment of postage only. There were few options. So this unauthorized use led to the trade of postage stamps, even though their only endpoint, redemption, came when used to mail a letter or package.
Interesting.
And that's why you should all use stamps.com to mail your letters or packages.
We use it around here.
Boy,
that,
do we
That
ever.
Was also Noel Brown at the end. Boy, that wasn't Dave.
Boy, do we ever. So a black market for stamps, right, with the Kansas All Dave. Back to Dave. I'm speaking as Dave, channeling Dave. A black market for stamps with the cancellation stamp washed off developed both for trade and for postage being used until they were too damaged or dirty. So stamps were never printed on special currency paper or with extra security measures, making counterfeiting easy.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to believe for us, but small fortunes could be made on what was basically penny postage. Dave, that was glorious on so many levels.
Yep. What a fantastic letter.
Just a history nugget.
Stamp fraud's a real thing. There's a stamp tycoon out
That's
there.
That's why you should use stampfraud.com for all your postal fraudulent, for all your fraudulent postage needs.
I really want to know what Dave does for a living.
He teaches people amazing facts. That's true. Thank you very much to Dave, Jenna, and Linnell. This concludes our...
And if you want to be like Dave and Linnell and Jenna and send us some information, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook where we are Conspiracy Stuff. You can share images with us and look at pictures of Ben hanging out in the studio on our Instagram account.
Or still, Noel had some great pictures from an excursion to D.C. that
yes.
are worth checking out.
And yeah. a book about Tesla I saw that you posted on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a book about Tesla that showed up.
We are Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. Check us out there. If you don't want to do any of those things and you just want to write to us, please send us an email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.stampfraud.
If you want...
Conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.